Okay, I'm going to get started now. We've got a pretty good turnout. I've been asked to remind everyone to turn off any cell phones or other noise-making devices. And, of course, fill out those nice white forms and hand them in when you leave. Okay, I'll get started now. My name is David Miles, and I'm going to be talking about crowds in a polygon soup. I'm going to show you a number of cool new techniques that I think you'll find very useful if you're doing something like large-scale fluid AI navigation in complex changing worlds. And at the end of the talk, you'll actually have the basic framework to go out and build a path planning, motion planning system for a next-gen console that'll really get a lot of attention. If you already have an existing system, I think you'll walk away with at least one or two cool techniques which you can use to improve or optimize your system. So there's going to be three parts to the talk today. First, I'm going to talk about building a usable free space graph. And by this, I mean we're going to encapsulate in an efficient data structure sort of the walkable areas of a level that the guys can move around on. And we'll need this so that we can efficiently do all of our fluid motion. And I'm going to show you some neat ways you can do a simple automated build process that'll extract this from a pretty polygon soup type mesh geometry that's passed in, and it's robust to a lot of problems you typically get when processing mesh. So you're gonna get a neat data structure there, and then, of course, you're gonna have, you know, dynamic obstacles that appear at runtime, you know, gas grenades thrown, you know, ceiling collapses, all these things that happen every day. And I'm gonna show you how you can actually update this usable free space graph so that, like, once the update's complete, it could completely reconfigure the paths that the guys are going to take around the world. And yet, all your underlying algorithms, you know, your A-star and your flocking stuff, are going to be able to run on this modified data structure just as they were able to run on your original data structure. Okay. And then finally, I'm going to show you some of the queries you can make against this data structure that let you do, you know, neat swarming, flocking kind of stuff. So I'm going to talk about all these, and I'm going to show you a number of demos. I'm actually going to start off right now with a demo to just give you a visual idea of what I'm talking about. So we've got this large world. We've got hundreds of guys moving around it. It's, you know, not really well-formed mesh. You know, we've got interpenetrating bits of mesh. We actually have a build process that takes all of the polygons in this level, and it processes them and spits out a graph of connected convex areas. And this actually represents all the areas which the guys can walk around on, you know, without falling off of the world or running into walls. And then we're actually able to do a bunch of queries against this mesh and against the other guys so that at runtime we can avoid each other, we can avoid the big guys, the small guys, we can actually swarm fluidly through different changes in shape of the terrain. So that's what I'm talking about today. So I'm going to go over just very briefly one slide each of these three areas, and then I'll dive into detail on section one. So building the nav graph. We're going to have very large worlds, organic, you know, extremely interpenetrating mesh. We want an automated build process that will be able to spit out this connected area graph. We want this process to be robust to poorly formed mesh. I mean, more and more, instead of having, you know, nice welded polys that your guys are running over, you're going to have, you know, piles of debris, you know, cinder blocks, boards and stuff that your guys are trying to navigate. So there'll be gaps and all kinds of things. So we need a build process that's going to work on this kind of mesh. And then finally, you know, even if you did convince some of your content people to build, you know, a nav mesh for you, like for this room, you know, that had a hallway and maybe areas between the seats, you know, what if you then want to have, you know, another nav mesh, you know, for a big monster who can just, like, walk right up on the stage, or, like, little, you know, robots that can run underneath the chairs. So the build process I'm going to show you can also easily accommodate building for different size guys, and that's a neat feature that you'll get out of that. Okay, so that's the build process. Then for the dynamic obstacles, we're not just talking about, you know, you had a straight line path across the room and a crate landed there, and now we're going to sort of perturb that and find a path that goes around the extreme points of the crate. We're talking about potentially, you know, the crate lands in the doorway and now the guys have to go out and around and in a different door, something like that. Potentially, you know, a lot of gas grenades are thrown down by the player specifically to keep the enemies away. So you can end up with paths that now go significantly in a significantly different way than they went originally. So the way we're going to address this is we're going to actually replace the static areas at runtime that are affected by these obstacles with dynamic areas that we compute at runtime. And the neat thing about this is that when you're done, all of your underlying algorithms work exactly like they did on the original static graph. So all of your flocking, all your A star. So it's a neat trick, and I'll talk about that. And then finally, for the fluid AI navigation, there's a number of things you can do, you know, given this convex area graph data structure. You know, you can do quickly detect where walls are, where drop-offs are, potential fields if you're doing flocking. And actually, I'm going to concentrate most on a neat technique for path following that'll let you get your groups of guys expand out when there's a lot of free space and then nicely move inwards to get through doorways. So I think all of these will be neat, and I'll concentrate on number four. Okay. So now the automated build process. This is our little example level. We've got a hallway entrance into the skull cave. It's very complicated geometry, just passed in as an array. We don't have any connectivity information. So what we do is very simple. I'm just going to show you the 2D for now. We'll get to 3D in a minute. We're going to voxelize or rasterize on a regular grid every grid element that has any portion of a polygon in it will simply mark as filled. So very simple operation. And now simply, we're going to walk around that perimeter of filled elements. And as we walk along the wall, we're going to generate this non-convex polyline that has a lot of segments. And that's really the perimeter around the surface, which is the surfaces which the guys can move on. Okay, and now another straightforward step. We're just going to simplify that polygon, just removing some of the edges, keeping the resulting edge, you know, within some tolerance. And now the first sort of non-trivial step, we want to partition this non-convex polygon into a connected graph of convex polygons. And there's actually a number of ways you can do this. You know, there's standard triangulation ones that'll break it down into triangles. You can also do complicated dynamic programming solutions that will actually find an optimal partitioning in terms of the number of areas. I'm going to show you actually, I think it's a good compromise. It's easy to go and implement. It's moderately fast, and it gives quite good results. So we're going to do it by recursively splitting this non-convex polygon into sub-polygons until we end up only with convex polygons. And so the real question is, where do we choose these split locations? And, you know, as a human, you can say, well, we should make one at some of the choke points. We should split it where, you know, it narrows down. And so algorithmically, the way we can do that is if we actually just compare all possible vertex pairs around this non-convex polygon, and we try to minimize the ratio of the straight line distance to the perimeter distance around the outside. If we look for the minimum value of that comparing all vertices, we'll actually find a choke point that we want to use. Now, this is an n-squared operation, but this is a pre-processing step, and in practice, this is rarely, if ever, a bottleneck. So we do that. We find a place to make a split. We break it into two sub-polygons that we have to maintain the connectivity information there because we'll need it later. And then we recurse. And we do that again. Okay. We end up with a graph of convex areas, and we know the connectivity information between them. And so at this point, we're able to actually do pathfinding. So that's the very fast five-minute overview, and now I'm going to go over a number of issues with that, because I'm sure you've got questions in your mind at this point. So the first thing is, you know, what are the problems? So you go and implement this, and you run into something, and you say, you know, but David Miles told me this would work. So the first thing is you're going to end up with holes in your surface. So like if the skull cave has eyes now, and these might be pits or, you know, columns that go up to the ceiling, but they're things that the AIs need to avoid. So when you do your voxelization, you go around the perimeter, you extract a polyline, you're going to end up now not just with one polyline around the outside, but you'll have these little polylines around any of the holes in the surface. And let me actually skip this slide slightly better. What we want to do is we'd like to, if we could introduce some splices where going around the outside, we'd travel into the interior holes and move around them and then go back out to the outside. We could actually convert this problem if we spliced in both those holes. We could convert this problem to a single polyline, non-convex polyline, and we could run our partitioning algorithm on it just like we did before. So we want to find good locations to make these splices, and we actually, instead of minimizing any ratio, if we actually just compare pairs of vertices, you know, one on the outside and one on the inside, and just find the minimum distance, so we're looking for the closest approach point, and do the splices there, and add at two edges at each splice, we end up with a single non-convex polygon that, you know, goes all the way around, goes into the eyes, around, and back out to the outside. So now we can run our previous partitioning algorithm on it, and we get a graph of connected areas, and we can do pathfinding. Okay, so that was the first issue, and there's four more I'll go over. So the other thing, obviously, is I said I would get to the 3D, and so the question is, I've just been showing you a top-down view. What is this? What are some of the issues you get looking at this from the side to do full 3D? So the first is overhead obstacles. Now, you can see here on the bottom of the screen, you know, we have what would be extracted as a walkable surface all the way under that low-hanging obstacle on the right-hand side of the screen. But, you know, imagine that our guy can't go there because he can't duck down or something. He doesn't have animations for that. So we don't want to extract that as part of a walkable surface. So what we do is we simply, from every filled element of the grid, we traverse downwards by a number of units corresponding to the height of the guy, and we simply eliminate or clear a flag in any element that was previously marked as filled. And so now we've eliminated that walkable surface over on the right-hand side, and when we go around and extract our perimeter, that won't be part of our final area graph. Okay, so that's one thing. Another thing you might be wondering is, because it still looks like sort of a 2.5D solution, so you might have something like a hallway that goes down and then turns and has, you know, a spiral staircase and comes up and overlaps. Now, of course, there's plenty of room, you know, for the guy to run in the hallway down below and then for him to come up and cross over up above. But if you run your partitioning algorithm looking at it as purely a 2D situation, you'll see what appears to be an intersection between your desired partition that you want to make and the polyline that's above. And so what you'll want to do is, anytime you're trying to do a partitioning split, and you see that there's a potential intersection between two lines, you need to look at the vertical separation at that point. And if it's greater, you know, than the height of the guy that you're building this for, then you can ignore that intersection and consider that to be still a valid partition. Now, it's interesting, and this was very interesting to me writing some of this code, that you can actually go for a long time without ever having to add, you know, that check. And the question is, why does the 2D algorithm, you know, work for these really 3D levels? And the answer is that very often, let's say it thought that was an invalid split, there'll be other valid splits in the level. And once it makes those, you know, it breaks the two subsections apart. It's considering them separately now. And so you've removed the overlap from the problem, and it's able to go on and make those splits that it wanted to originally. So you might get very slightly suboptimal splitting, but it'll actually work quite well. So that was just interesting to me. Okay, two more issues that'll come up. I've been talking about how you could use this build process to very easily account for creatures of different sizes, and you may be able to guess sort of how you could do the different heights now based on one of my 3D slides. But let's talk about guys of different radii. So you've got a big guy who can't even fit from the hallway into the skull cave. What do we do about that? So we do the initial voxelization exactly as we did before. But now we're actually going to fill inwards from all the edges where the walls were by a number of units corresponding roughly to the radii of the guy. In this case, we're just filling in by one unit. And then when you go and extract the edge by doing your perimeter edge walk, you'll actually end up with two disjoint areas in this example. And that's really indicative of the fact, you know, the guy can move up and down in the hallway and he can move around inside the skull cave, but he can't get from one area to the other. Now, the way you actually do this fill inwards is you just do a flood fill, but you start instead of like with a single node, your open list starts with all of the perimeter nodes, and so you just fill inwards from there. Now, of course, in this example, it looks very coarse, and in practice, you want to run this with a significantly higher granularity than what I've shown here. Ideally, you know, you want to run maybe with like four voxelization elements, you know, within the diameter of the guy. If you run with, you know, much higher, you're just wasting CPU and memory. If you run with less, then there'll be places where it appears that a guy should fit, but your built graph doesn't allow it. And I'll actually show you a demo with some of that. Okay. One final issue. So, of course, I say you want to run with a higher voxelization resolution, but you're probably saying, but David, you know, this is going to be n-cubed on a regular grid in memory in terms of the n-cubed, where n is the width of the level in grid elements. And that's true. So you might want to start, if you've got small levels or some other part of your build process breaks things down into small chunks, you can use a regular grid. It's very easy. If you're doing large levels, especially large sparse levels, you're much better using some kind of spatial partition. And my favorite at the moment, and what I've drawn here, is an octree. Well, I've drawn a quad tree. The neat thing is that as you build your octree, and you're splitting each node by three planes to create your eight child nodes, you can at that same time split all of your input polygons, which is just a clipping operation, and generate the polygons for the child nodes. And thereby, actually, as you build down, you automatically know at the end sort of which nodes are filled with terrain. So anyway, it's a little trickier, but that's what you want to do to get really be able to process really big levels without running out of memory. So let me show you a demo now in just a little test level of what this process looks like as we change the parameters for the radius of the guy and the voxelization size. Okay, so we've got three paths between these two circular pads, and we've got a bunch of guys who are going back and forth. And you can see in green the convex area graph that it's built. So now if I increase the radius of the guys, the path in the middle, raised walkway is broken because it's not actually wide enough for those guys to fit. We're assuming they don't want, you know, any portion of themselves to hang over the edge. you know, this was the small guys that could go across. The bigger guys have to go around to the right. The really big guy has to go around to the left. And you can sort of see that the graph is sort of retracting away from the edges as we switch that slider. Okay, so that was the radius. Now the next thing I want to show is I'm going to change the voxelization size here. And you can see in the lower left-hand side of the screen, we've got this blue grid that changes in resolution. And that's the grid, that's the spacing that we're voxelizing the world on. And so you can see actually here, going from this high resolution down, you'll look at some of the curved surfaces and how well the convex area graph approximates them. You can see that it gets coarser and coarser as you do that. So, and actually if you look at the number of areas you get, that also gets lower and lower as you go in a coarser and coarser resolution. So this is interesting. Generally you want to run at a relatively high resolution, but if you want to do a very fast build, you can run at a lower resolution and you'll get, you know, an n-squared type speed up. Okay, so that's what it basically looks like. And now I'll go on to talk about dynamic obstacles. So we've got this great graph. We'll be able to later do all kinds of cool things with it. What happens when we have a dynamic obstacle that appears in the level? And like I said, we're talking about ones that could completely reconfigure the world. And so what we're going to do is we're actually going to replace the affected static areas with dynamic areas and create a new graph based on the original one where all the underlying algorithms still work exactly as they did before. So actually, I should say the dynamic obstacle section of the talk is probably going to be the shortest. Most of the hard work implementing it has to do with doing a 2D Boolean, which isn't trivial, but, you know, it's not that hard either, and you can look it up. And also in managing all the pointer connectivity between the different areas as you remove the static ones and add the dynamic ones, which, once again, is not trivial, but it's an implementation detail. So the primary operation we're doing here is Boolean subtraction. So we've got our five areas in our test case here, and we're subtracting our one for the now convex obstacle. And, you know, we've got some areas like A and E that nothing happens to, so that's easy. We've got some areas like B and C that get broken down into two sub-areas. So you can have one static area that can produce multiple dynamic areas. And then we've got D, where we actually create one non-convex dynamic area by doing the Boolean subtraction. So we'll need to do something about that later. Before I go on, let me actually say you do have some options here. One thing you could do is you could take sort of B, C, and D, and you could combine them together, basically remove the shared edges between them and create a non-convex polygon that went around those three, then subtract the obstacle from that, and then partition that resulting one. And that would actually give you slightly fewer dynamic areas in general. It has some disadvantages. It's a little bit more complicated. And what I'm going to show you here actually is simpler because the area B produces two dynamic areas. And later on, we've got this one-to-one mapping, like this static area produced these dynamic areas. So later, if we remove an obstacle there, we know what to get rid of. And all of the dynamic areas corresponding to one static area end up in one place in memory. So there's some advantages in terms of simplicity. So what I'm describing is you just go through and you do a Boolean subtraction sequentially of your obstacle with each of the static areas. Okay. So we've got this one area D where we created, after the Boolean subtraction, we ended up with a non-convex area. So we need to deal with that basically by partitioning it. And you can use the algorithm I showed you before in the build process. Since this is runtime here that you're doing that, you may want to use a simpler algorithm to do your partitioning. That isn't n squared or worse in time. But you partition that or you partition any areas that end up being non-convex. You restore the connectivity between all your dynamic areas, and you're done. I mean, that is, in an overview, that's basically it. And now all your guys can use this updated graph, and if you made your Boolean fast, it's actually a pretty fast operation to do. Okay, so what are the issues there that you're going to run into? So the big one is multiple obstacles. So you can imagine, after you've done one Boolean, you've actually had one obstacle that's already appeared there. You did your Boolean subtract, you did your partitioning, you did all your connectivity fix up, and now another obstacle appears. So there's a few ways you can deal with this. Obviously, if it's appearing in a different part of the graph, different area, no problem. The problem is when two of them are affecting the same area. So what you might do at first is you might actually just subtract it, do a Boolean subtraction of it from D2 and D3 that you had created before. And that works. The problem is, there's actually two problems. One problem, probably the foremost, is that you tend to create some small sliver areas, and as you add more and more dynamic obstacles in, you create more and more of these little slivers. And that ends up being pretty messy, and there's a better solution that will get you something like that. The other problem with this sort of incremental subtraction is that if you imagine the memory layout, which I'll actually show you a little bit on the next slide, but when we did the dynamic obstacle that created D1, D2, D3, we could allocate those as a single place in memory. But now if we leave D1 there, but get rid of D2 and D3 and create some new ones, we're going to end up sort of putting dynamic areas all over memory. So it's another disadvantage of doing this sort of incremental subtraction. So what actually I'd recommend in most situations is that when you have the second obstacle show up, you actually throw out, which is very fast, the dynamic areas D1, D2, D3 that you had created there. And now you actually subtract first obstacle and second obstacle, and then partition that resulting non-convex polygon. And that gives you a much cleaner set of dynamic areas. And it also means that you can keep all of the dynamic areas that are associated with one static area, you can keep them in a single chunk of memory. So, of course, there's one major drawback to this. In case you haven't guessed it, obviously, if you've got, let's say, 20 obstacles in an area, and you add the 21st, you got rid of all your dynamic areas, which was fast, but now you have to do the Boolean subtraction of your 1, 2, 3, all of your obstacles again. So potentially, if you have a game where you've got, you know, vast numbers of crates stacked in one room that's small and just is represented by one area, it could be an issue. And you might want to do an approach where you do a hybrid approach where sometimes you do an incremental subtraction, sometimes you do the full rebuild of that area. So that's an option that you have. So that's how you deal with multiple obstacles. I just have one more slide about this, and that's the memory layout that I was talking about. So these areas, since they have different number of edges to each of them, they're different sizes. And in the static build process, since it's offline, you can pre-compute all their sizes. You can pack them together in a single chunk of memory. And that's really good. You can load them in super fast. You can, you know, typically you're talking less than 100K of memory. You can move it to another core if you want to process it there. So that's very good. The dynamic areas, since they're different sizes, we need to create them at runtime. We end up having to dynamically allocate them. Now you probably want to have, depending on your memory allocation philosophy, but you probably want to have a separate little heap just for your dynamic areas so you don't end up with fragments in the main heap. But you do need to dynamically allocate them somewhere. So originally we had connectivity between these areas in our static graph. And now when we add the dynamic areas, we actually can just move the pointers from the exterior non-updated static areas, move them so that they point to the new dynamic areas. And the nice thing is that then if our obstacle goes away and cleans up that section of the graph, we can just restore our pointers right back to how they were before, and we have our original continuous set of memory. So that's what I was talking about when it's nice to have a one-to-one mapping between a static area and the dynamic areas that it's created, so you can easily like undo work and roll back to your original state if obstacles go away. And in certain cases, like gas grenades, that's going to be really useful because they'll frequently be appearing and then disappearing. Okay. So now, what are we going to do with this graph? So there's a lot of neat things you can do to get fluid motion if you've got squads of guys moving through your levels, or if you have got large crowds of guys, you've got swarms of enemies. We're really going to be pushing the number of guys, and it's always a headache trying to get them to move nicely together, not run through each other, avoid vehicles that are driving in their midst, that kind of thing. So the first, you can do very fast navigational ray casts. And we're talking, you know, generally 100 times faster than a collision probe. You also can detect things easily that are hard to detect with a collision probe. You know, you can check out in front of you. You can easily see a wall with a collision probe. But it's much harder to detect, you know, a drop-off that you're about to run off of. But with our graph, we've got edges of each of the areas where there's a drop-off. And so we can easily do a ray cast against that and avoid, you know, running over the edge. You can do a lot of probes around you, but sometimes you just want to know things like, you know, you want to do a super move and you need, you know, 5 feet of clear space so you can do that. You can easily iterate around the edges of the areas, your current area and the adjacent ones, finding the minimum distance. So you can do other useful, AI useful things like that. If you're doing a flocking type movement solution, you can do a repulsion field away from the edges quite easily. And I'll show you, you can do that. In some cases, it's not actually what you want to do, but it is quite easy to do with this kind of graph. And then finally, you can do what I'm going to be calling smart path following, and I'll actually go into a fair bit of detail on that. Okay, first, just one slide on the ray cast in case it's not immediately obvious. So you want to probe out, you know, in front or to the left or the right, find out how close you are to the terrain, either play a different behavior animation or just move your velocity vector. So we're looking in a certain direction for the point at which that ray projected out would hit an obstacle edge there, you know, either a wall or a drop-off. If we're starting, you know, from the area that the enemy was in, you know, the previous frame, we probably even know what area that is. We don't even have to do a login lookup. So this can be extremely fast. We just iterate around the edges of our current area, checking for an intersection of our ray with those edges. And if we find an intersection with an obstacle edge, you know, we're done. If we find an intersection with a connected edge, then we have to traverse into the next area starting from that intersection point and repeat the process. So eventually, you know, we find an intersection with obstacle edge, generally, you know, after traversing only two or three areas. You could be concerned about the situation where you've got, you know, a long hallway that wiggles just a little bit side to side to break it up into lots and lots of connected areas. And, you know, what happened if you iterated down 100 areas? So generally in practice, if you're doing navigational ray casts, it's fine if you limit it to 10 areas. Even if you did 100 areas, it would probably still be several times faster than doing a collision check. And in practice, it almost never happens. Okay, so that's the ray cast. And now I'm going to spend pretty much the rest of the talk talking about the smart path following, which really is a key element to getting some nice sort of group squad-like behavior of guys moving together. Okay, smart path following. So in the top diagram, I've got a picture. What we'd like to have is when a group of guys comes into a room and there's plenty of space around them, you know, they spread out apart from each other. They aren't all like squished up against each other, even when there's lots of space. But then when they get towards the doorway on the far side, you know, we'd like for them to come together so that they can fit, you know, single file through the exit. And as you've probably seen, it doesn't always work well, even with real humans. But that's the kind of behavior we like. And the problem is that typically what's done when you're doing flocking is you extract out a polyline path, you know, maybe a minimum distance path. And then to keep everyone on that path, they attract towards it with some force, or maybe more likely they attract towards some lead point that's up ahead on the path. And the problem is, as soon as you extract out this polyline path, you throw away the information about how much free space there is around you. And so you really can't adapt to the free space. You can't spread out and then contract inwards. Now, typically what you do to get a little of this behavior back in is you actually apply a repulsion field away from the walls. And if you've got, you know, a funnel, you know, if you've got a funnel, it works fabulously going towards your exit. If you've got just straight walls, you know, it works okay. But invariably, when you're processing, you know, a large volume of a sort of organic mass, you end up with the bad situation where you've got the walls near the exit point away, and you get local minimum, and the guys go off to the side, and it looks bad. And so the nice thing is there's actually a good way to deal with this problem that'll actually get you the behavior you want without having to do any repulsion away from the edges. So one more motivation slide. For the path planning connoisseur, and this is something that annoys me, but honestly, you can ship a lot of games without dealing with this. When a guy, you know, avoids some big group of guys, some big enemies, he goes away from his original path. It would be nice if, you know, then he would just head towards the exit as opposed to sort of going away and then coming back to his minimum distance path and then going towards the exit. So it's as if, you know, once he went out of his way, if at that moment he recomputed the minimum distance path, you know, he'd be golden. He could head straight for the exit. And so it turns out, actually, we can do that. We don't actually have to recompute or compute a minimum distance path. In fact, all we need to know to get a good behavior here is we need to know the next corner on what would be our minimum distance path, and we can just head towards that next corner always, and we'll actually get a very good flocking behavior. So in case that wasn't clear, there's several more slides on it. So what I'm proposing we do is that every member of the flock is just going to steer towards what would be the next corner on the minimum distance path if they recomputed it at that moment. And so the question is, how do we compute that next corner very quickly? And luckily, you know, it's very easy given this connected area graph. So a couple more slides describing the problem. So we're at some current location. We've got some goal. We've already found the set of areas that we're going to be traveling through originally when we did our A-star search, but we may be pushed out of our way within any one of those areas. So the next corner, you know, in this case there's only one corner, the next corner I also sometimes refer to as the last visible point along the minimum distance path. So you can imagine if you were like standing in the first area, the area where you are, looking down this series of areas, and eventually it goes off to the right. The last visible point, if you pull the string tight between you, you know, and the goal, the last visible point on that path would be where it hit that next corner. So that's the point we want to head to. And of course, you know, if you applied that repeatedly, you went to that corner and then you found the next corner, you would be over time generating the minimum distance path. You just don't generate it all at once. So if you imagine that each of these areas, you know, is a cell and there's portals between them at the shared edges, we actually know that the minimum distance path, the corners in the minimum distance path, are going to be a subset of the endpoints of these portals. And so this is from a sort of a rendering point of view. We're at the current location looking through these cells, looking through these portals, and our minimum distance path is going to go down, and eventually it's going to, unless we can see the goal already, it's going to turn to one side or the next, and we need to find that corner where it turns. Okay, So now the algorithm. So I'm going to show you a pretty simple iterative algorithm, go through three iterations. We're going to have two state variables in the algorithm, the last vis left and the last vis right point. And let's see, we'll go through the first loop here. So we initialize the state variables to be the endpoints of the first portal. And now each time, each iteration, we consider one more portal. So we're considering the left point of the next portal here. So the left point is in the view angle from the starting location. And so because it's in the view angle, it's visible, it's actually going to be used to update the state of the last vis left point when we like conclude this iteration. And likewise, for the right endpoint of this new portal, it's inside the view angle, so it'll be used to update the state. Now, the other options, of course, is that it could be outside to the left or outside to the right, which we'll cover in the next iterations. You should also note that although I'm saying angle here, you don't actually need to do any angle computations, which is good because they're often slow. You really only need to do two cross products here between the vector from the current to the new location and the vector to the left, old left and right positions. And in fact, since it's 2D, you know, you don't even need to do full cross products, so it's probably just as fast on most of our processors to do that. So it's a very fast computation per iteration, just two cross products and some compares. So at the end of the first iteration, we update our two state variables. And now in the second iteration, we consider our new left point. And it's actually out of view on the left-hand side. And so it can't be seen from the starting location. It's clearly not the last visible point, so we're not going to update anything. And now we consider the right point. It's the same as the previous iteration, so we're going to do a state update based on it. Okay, new state. Okay, now this is actually the final iteration. The new left-hand point is actually outside on the right. So the entire portal is now outside on the right, which means the path must have turned off to the right. And so our output for the whole, that terminates the loop, and the output for the algorithm is that last vis right point. And likewise, you know, if the new right point had been off outside to the left, our output would have been our last vis left point. So this is actually really fast. You know, typically you're only looking, you know, three or four areas along your path. And it's actually much faster than your repulsion or steering type calculations. And everyone can do that. And it gives you a very nice behavior. And let me show you a demo of that in action. So we've got a bunch of guys here. They're drawing the line to the next corner that they're computing. And you'll see here, as they come out into this open area, they're actually able to spread out like we wanted them to do when there was a lot of free space. And then as they get towards the far side, they actually come back in to fit nicely through the doorway there. And at the bottom, I've shown this sort of like worst case wiggly, long wiggly hallway where right in the middle, they can see all the way down to their goal location. But as they get off to the side, you know, they're seeing a next corner that's a lot closer. And that sort of force that's angled actually tends to pull the flock back together. So you get a very nice behavior there of them moving, adjusting, able to, you know, spread out in large free spaces and then come back together when it's a tight area. Okay. So the summary of the next corner determination. So it's easy to do. It's very fast. If you're worried about these long hallways, you can easily limit the number of iterations, just heading towards sort of the middle point of the 10th area. As you get closer, unless you reach your goal, the path will bend off to the left or right, and you can turn to the left or right. And that limitation, no one will ever notice that kind of limitation. It's neat that you never explicitly have to extract the minimum distance path all at once. And that's neat partly because, you know, certainly in a few systems that I've written, that can be a one-frame bottleneck. If a lot of guys request long paths, actually computing the minimum distance path along the whole length can provide a hiccup, you know, that frame. And so here we've essentially spread it out from frame to frame. Of course, the real reason we're doing this is that we're able to do this sort of fluid AI navigation with significant perturbations where we get pushed off of our path and still always move, you know, in a fluid way towards the next corner. So it gives us a very nice flocking behavior moving around in this terrain. Okay, and so that's actually it. I'm going to go over briefly what I talked about. So we did the automated build process. And I think the voxelization approach is a good, simple approach that lets you build a graph that really encapsulates the walkable area of the level so the guys can move around it. It's super robust to all kinds of mesh issues where you've got interpenetrations and gaps. And it's also very easy to build essentially a configuration space graph for different sizes and heights of enemies. So that's a neat approach. And then I talked about how you can, using a 2D Boolean, you can update the graph in a really comprehensive way so that any kinds of queries that we did to our original graph now work exactly on our updated graph. And it can account for sort of any kind of reconfiguration of the level due to strange placement of adjacent obstacles. And of course, there's no speed overhead, you know, once we've done the update. And then finally, I talked about some of the queries that you can do on this graph. Though will help out with a lot of the AI algorithms if you have this as your underlying data structure. And introduce the smart path following that lets us quickly find the next corner and never have to explicitly compute the minimum distance path. So that's it. I wanted to thank my wife, Mei-Lin, Hong and Dave on the Tomb Raider AI team, and Crystal Dynamics. And if you have any questions and there's not time now, definitely send me email at babbleflux.com. And if you want to get a copy of these slides, they're also up on our website in the technology section at babbleflux.com. So with that, I'll take any questions. The microphone there is on and working, so if you could go up there, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll repeat your question. What's that?
Just put the last
slide. Sure. Yeah, no, go ahead.
So you have to, you talked about having your game support multiple AI sizes, but it looks like under your algorithm, you have to generate a complete path graph for every type of AI?
Yeah. So what I've described today, if you've got big guys and small guys, you actually generate a separate graph for each of them. Now, this is a little bit, you know, a choice that you'd have to make depending on the kind of guys that you have in your level. If you've got hundreds of guys, you don't really want to be doing the configuration. You don't want to be adjusting for the radius of the guys at runtime just because it's a lot more expensive. So if you've got hundreds of guys of one size and hundreds of another size, building separate graphs is a good solution. If instead your game has, you know, 10 guys, each one of a very different size, you might want to build a single graph and adjust your flocking, basically build the configuration space at runtime. So does that answer the question?
Well, what happens when you have dynamic obstacles and you've got update?
Yeah. So dynamic obstacles need to be grown by the size of the creature. So if, let's say, you have three graphs, you know, for small, medium, and big guys, when you add a dynamic obstacle to the world, you need to update each of those graphs. And each time you do it, for the small guys, you only grow the obstacle by a little bit. For the big guys, you grow the obstacle by a large amount. So yes, you need, if you had three graphs, you would need to update each of those graphs for a dynamic obstacle. Now, there are some neat advantages you get. Often, you know, like a crate or something blocks the humans, but the big mech, you know, can step right over it. So you can actually not put that obstacle at all in the graph for the big guys. So there's some advantages, but definitely if you've got a lot of different sizes of guys, you may not want to go with a multiple graph approach, but it is a lot simpler.
How would you handle jumping with the system?
Can you repeat that?
How would you handle jumping?
Jumping.
Yeah.
So what we've talked about here is just guys running around on the terrain. Actually, there was one step that I didn't cover where you actually have a step size for the guys. So sort of there are certain height steps which you allow them. You just build a continuous graph in that area. It's not separated. So for small step changes, is actually built into the graph. But for jumping large distances, typically what we've done is had manually authored, basically, jump helpers that go from one area to another area. So there's two platforms in space, but you know that a guy can jump from one to the other. Often that's appealing to the designers because they can limit where the guys are gonna jump. However, if you're making a game where everyone can jump, you know, all over the place, what I've shown today would not solve that. There'd be other steps you need to do. Because really this is dealing with the walkable spaces, so we're dealing with guys that walk around. We're not dealing with flying guys. If we were, the voxelization steps are still good, but you need a very different data structure to encapsulate the 3D volumes. And once again, what I talked about today is also not directly applicable to wall crawling or ceiling crawling creatures. Several of the steps are, but several of the steps need to be changed to do that. So yeah, this is primarily for guys who are walking around.
Thank you.
It seems like a lot of the examples were indoor type paths. Have you done any testing with like large organic outdoor terrains?
So I've done only medium sort of large outdoor terrain type situations. The problems you run into, so if you've got a big outdoor situation, it works fine. You just need to increase your voxel size so that you're not you're only processing, you know, a few million sort of surface voxels. So in a large world, you don't try to still voxelize, you know, with a 6-inch, you know, wide voxel. The problem you run into is if you have a very large world with big open areas and then you've got like a little house with all kinds of nooks and crannies that the guys need to be able to run around in, so you have to have, you know, a 6-inch voxel size so someone can hide behind the fridge, but then you need to do this huge world, then you have a problem. And so to do something like that, you actually need to have variable size voxels depending on the area that you're in. So the problem is really dynamic range of the geometry that you're interested in moving around in. Next.
If you have a large number of dynamic obstacles, is there any advantage to making like a bounding volume around those dynamic obstacles?
Very, very, very much so. And we've seen cases where, like a truck or something like that was composed of a number of sub-obstacles, and yeah, you get a big advantage from combining them together. Or if you've got a stack of crates, just creating one obstacle that represents those three crates is a win as well. So yes.
I have two questions if I can. The first one is, you use N-gon convex regions for the areas of the graph.
Yeah.
Is there an advantage to using an N-gon versus just making everything a triangle?
Right. So here's a big possible advantage, and it depends on your exact situation. So the problem is that, and I meant to mention this in my talk, but the worst case performance for an A-star search is generally N squared. And typically you've got, if you triangulate it, you have 3 to 4 times as many triangles as you would have N-gons. So your performance, worst case, is 9 to 16 times worse. So that's the advantage of going with the N-gons. The disadvantage is that it makes a number of bits of the code more complicated, but it makes your searching potentially 10 times faster, worst case. So it's a trade-off.
Okay, and I guess my next question was already answered by that answer, which is what are you running at real time to determine, you know, where you're going to move to get from this N-gon to this N-gon, and you're running A-star.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, generally I do a star search and extract out a list of areas that you're moving through, and then keep that list around during the traversal, because you're going to be able to be pushed sort of out of your way within that swath of areas that you're moving through. So yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So the question was, what do you do with characters that get outside the walkable area but are still standing on something? And, you know, I'm imagining this could potentially happen if guys get thrown or something like that and end up somewhere where, for some reason, the automated process didn't build a walkable mesh. And I guess at the moment, the demos that I showed you, when they tried to find a path, they would actually snap back inside the closest. That's probably not a production quality solution. In previous games I've worked on, we've, you know, had them play a different animation or try to jump or have some different fallback solution. You know, the other approach would be, it's very easy to collide against the edge of the walkable space. So I would imagine, in fact, much of the time, you got knocked back, you might just, in addition to colliding with geometry, collide with the edge of the walkable area graph. And of course, if you hit an edge that was a drop-off, you might decide at that point, if you're traveling fast enough, to ignore the edge and actually just keep traveling. So a range of options. So the question is, have I considered a case where a dynamic obstacle would bridge two areas of the walkable surface? And if I understand correctly, that's what I was trying to show, that a dynamic obstacle can land where it crosses and a dividing area between two walkable areas that are connected. And in that case, you just sequentially update each of the areas. But let's see if you've got a clarification there.
The question I'm asking is, the dynamic obstacle is actually walkable, so that I can walk from one to the other.
Ah, yeah, okay. So, like, you could have, let's say, a bridge that falls down between two raised platforms, now allowing guys to run across it. And typically the way that I've dealt with that situation is actually to have the designer's author invisible geometry that spans that, and then have an invisible dynamic obstacle that's blocking it off during initial portions of the game, so that when the actual, you know, so that there is this static graph that goes across that's blocked off. When the actual bridge falls, you remove this invisible obstacle, and now guys can run across it. So that's a little bit of an ad hoc solution. I'm actually working on some stuff now that is able to add in manually authored sections of mesh into this automatically generated graph. So that actually goes beyond what I'm talking about today. But it would be neat to be able to have mesh on the dynamic obstacle, and as it fell, it would connect up and guys would be able to run across the bridge. At the moment, it requires more sort of behind the scenes work.
Where large units would spontaneously amplify your voice, but where two diagonal obstacles would block a unit where it didn't visually block. Like if two obstacles are laid in diagonal to each other, if you just scale their box, you're sort of over blocking. Did you run into that problem in practice, or was it slight enough?
Okay, so we'll see whether this answers the question. So one of the issues we have here actually is that when we're expanding, like let's say a rectangle by the radius of the guys, I'm actually expanding it, turning it into a larger box, which at the corners is actually moving it out by, you know, 1.4 times the radius. So you could actually have two boxes near each other where There's actually room for the guy to fit between, and yet the pathfinding system says that he can't. And yes, that happens. In fact, I should say, in general, the whole system is predicated on the fact that you're creating these voxels so that actually all of your widths of all your areas can be off by plus or minus a voxel width, because you don't know where in that voxel your actual polygons were. So basically this comes down to, you know, if you've got 6-inch voxels and your guy is 30 inches wide, you know, don't make the hallway 32 inches wide. Because, you know, depending on exactly how it shifted on the mesh, it may or may not be able to generate a walkable area through that. In general, people are pretty comfortable with that kind of issue. But yeah, it does come up. Okay, we got time for one more question, if anyone's got one. Maybe I just scared the last remaining questioner there. Wait, there's one more. Yeah, and so what we would do, the question was, did I handle the case where an obstacle might move due to another explosion? And yeah, we've certainly had cases, you know, where you've got a bunch of crates and an explosion goes off and moves them all to another location. And we just handle that as removing the crate from the old location, and then when it settled down, adding it in the new location. So I should say that although you could use this, you know, for maybe one dynamic obstacle that was moving, you could do this update every frame. This is really for things that appear in one location and then might move and then are in another location. If they're moving every frame, you need to basically deal with that in your flocking solution. So yes, crates, you know, that might move again due to an explosion get removed from the graph as a dynamic obstacle, and then a second or so later when they settle down in the new location, get added back in. Okay, so that's it. Thank you very much for coming, and remember to turn in your form.